welcome back to the ESVS podcasts. This is Laurence Bertrand.
And this is Justin Woolgar.
And you are listening to the ESVS podcasts. After extensively covering the new ESVS trauma guidelines with speakers from the writing committee in our last four episodes, we invite you today to join us for a distinctly non-European perspective. Today, we ask experts from a country with more than its fair share of vascular trauma to share their experience with us and their take on the guidelines. And we use this opportunity to ask for some insights into vascular surgery in their country. That is, of course, South Africa.
I'm happy to introduce Professor Balapile and Professor Damien Clark with us today. Professor Balapile is head of the Durban Metropolitan Vascular Service, based in Albert Luthuli Hospital, KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa. Also joining us today is trauma surgeon Professor Damien Clark, who is head of the Pietermaritzburg Metropolitan Trauma Service, based in Edendale Hospital, Pietermaritzburg, also in KwaZulu-Natal. Both have extensive experience in dealing with vascular trauma for almost 30 years. Welcome to the ESVS podcasts.
Thank you very much for that kind invitation. Looking forward to this participation. Thank you.
Good evening, colleagues, and good evening to my colleague from Pietermaritzburg, Professor Clark, and also to the host. Thank you for the kind invitation.
Professor Pillay, starting with you, let us begin by asking very broadly, what is your take on the ESVS trauma guidelines? Is there a South African counterpart, and how does it compare?
Yeah, look, firstly, I think it's a very comprehensive document, obviously tailored according to the European experience. So it's an important foundation and the first of its kind. So I think it definitely has value in terms of academia, in terms of training, and in terms of guideline principles, which I feel are broad brushstroke principles. From a South African perspective, we have our own local policy, and I speak from a Durban perspective. And so we've evolved these local policy guidelines based on our experience over the years. The other challenge we have from a developing perspective, you cannot have a discussion about management principles if you don't factor in the socioeconomics. And most often we see vascular injuries that are missed and vascular injuries that are delayed. I must commend the guideline working committee because they do acknowledge the deficiencies in the document, the gaps in the knowledge and areas of future research. So I commend the authors for giving us the A to Z in vascular trauma, and it's something that we can build on.
Thank you for that. Now, you've mentioned some specific recommendations already. Are there any specific recommendations that surprised you or perhaps do not resonate at all with the experience you have had?
Yeah, one of the glaring things relates to upper limb vascular trauma. And as my colleague, Professor Clark, will tell you, that 60% of our emergency practice is patients with brachial artery injuries. Now, one of my concerns is that when you are assessing a patient with a brachial artery injury, irrespective of the mechanism, it's very important to look at the neurological deficit. In other words, to assess the nerve injury, because the upper limb vascular trauma differs from the lower limb in that the outcome is not based on sticking two pieces of artery together and establishing luminal arterial flow. It's based on the functionality. Because if you do not treat the neurological fallout, then you basically end up with a cosmetic appendage. And we're quite fortunate in our center that one of our colleagues, our orthopedic colleagues, has trained at St. Mary's and is able to do these nerve transfers and nerve repairs. And so obviously the earlier you do it, the better the outcome for the patient. And it's been a win-win situation for us from that perspective. What I find in the guidelines, that this very superficially gleaned over there. And the other issue is that if you look at the brachial artery, there's some authors that have said it can be used as a training vessel and so forth based on the collaterals around the elbow and the shoulder. But if the patient has a congenital absence of a profunda vessel, you can end up with catastrophic consequences. So I think along those areas, I think I have concerns.
Thank you for that. I would like to ask about the new grading system that the ESVS has presented in its guidelines. And we spoke about this a little bit already. Briefly, grade 1 for intima lesion but overall integrity of the vascular wall, grade 2 for more extensive lesion of the wall with a pseudoaneurysm or an AV fistula, grade 3 with active bleeding, and grade X being an occlusion. Now, is this a system that represents what was already in use in your clinical practice, or are you categorizing vascular trauma entirely differently? Will this grading system be of any use to your context?
It helps you to triage the patients, which is awesome. It gives you an idea about the treatment modalities that are available. But that does not address the timing, the temporal sequence, stability of a patient. So there's lots of things that have to be factored into the equation. And then the other issue is that in terms of the grading system itself, I think in principle, it's a good idea, especially for somebody wanting to find out about the consequences of vascular trauma. But what concerns me is that you can't use a one-size-fits-all approach in terms of the various anatomical areas. And the same way, if you look at the Rutherford's classification for acute ischemia, and they tease it into 2A and 2B, but for me, limb is time, it's irrelevant whether it's 2A or 2B, because if it's at grade 2, the patient goes straight to theater without imaging because time is limb. See? But what concerns me about the grading system, look, it can be of use to somebody that's in training, that wants an idea about the pathology and so forth. For me, I would rather have an individual that appreciates the clinical science and assesses the patient holistically, because the first thing you do when you open a standard vascular textbook is having a high index of suspicion and looking for hard and soft signs.
Professor Clark, would it be a fair comment to say that in South Africa and similar developing countries, a significant amount of vascular trauma is managed by non-vascular surgeons such as trauma and general surgeons? In your opinion, how much awareness of these new guidelines do you believe there is? And if indeed there is a deficit, how do we bridge that gap in knowledge?
Thank you for that question, Justin. Obviously, you know, just in case, I don't know if people know, but Maritzburg is about an hour west of Durban. It drains a huge rural area of about 3 million people. So the patient gets injured in the hinterland, goes to a screening hospital there, then comes to Maritzburg and then gets assessed. So obviously not everybody can see a vascular surgeon. And to get the patients down to vascular can be a problem. Trauma surgeon or a general surgeon needs to have some basic understanding and some basic skills. I do think things have improved a lot in terms of what we can do. I'm not a vascular surgeon. I don't want to start trying to treat complex vascular problems. I want to identify them. I want to control obvious external bleeding. I want to try and avoid prolonged ischemia to a structure which is not going to respond, not do well with that. So the first thing is controlling the bleeding. I think that's, we've come back to the tourniquet. So obviously that must be used selectively. It shouldn't be used on all patients. If there is active ongoing bleeding, a tourniquet can be life-saving. It cannot be left on forever. So the tourniquet is another issue which has come back in. I don't see much mention in the guidance of the Foley balloon catheter. That does seem to work. So, I can't remember the last time I saw one of these dramatic bleeding necks that had to get rushed to theater, because usually if it is a little bit bleeding or oozing, if you stick a Foley balloon catheter in and blow it up, you can tamponade the bleeding, and that gives you time to then get a CT angiogram, discuss with your vascular colleagues and make some sort of a plan. So I think general surgeons, trauma surgeons need to be able to control external bleeding as part of their skill set. The next thing is identifying these injuries, right? Because that's the other cause, as Bala has said, of much woe, is people not recognizing. So that, you sort of need to, I suppose, we all, learn lessons the hard way, but the injuries around the knee, must always be viewed with great suspicion. You know, broken knees and tibial plateau injuries and lacerations. You have to learn to assume there's a popliteal artery injury there, because that's, you know, if that injury is missed and you then wait till the next morning, you know, and it can be quite subtle. You know, we've had, you know, these, so the obviously the, you know, a gunshot through there is quite spectacular, but we get these people who twist and rip their ligaments and sort of spin on their leg like a spinning top and get these popliteal artery thromboses. So every so often you have one of those horror stories. You know, a rather voluptuous lady was cleaning the floor and she slipped, twisted, and then she got shunted from pillar to post at some peripheral hospital and comes through to you with a dead leg and needs an above-knee amputation, which, and she's already a big lady, so she doesn't do well with losing a leg. So I think that's important. I think there's some things that have made our lives a lot easier. So as Bala said, the endovascular stuff has really changed things. You know, you don't need to do these horrendous thoracotomies, infraclavicular, supraclavicular incisions that we all used to love doing so much. You know, you can control the bleeding with a balloon catheter, image the patient, and then discuss and get the patient stented. Trauma stroke general surgeons are going to be seeing a lot of these patients, especially in, you know, rural KZN. We have to screen, we have to stop bleeding, we have to identify them, screen the patients, and then discuss with vascular as best we can.
Do you think that general surgeons in South Africa will be reading these guidelines?
Probably not. Trauma surgeons are more likely to be reading them. All right, so trauma is, I think it's pretty much a uniquely South African speciality. Maybe the Americans have it, you know, because we have so much of it, so you can make a career out of just treating injuries. So, you know, generally the place to push these is with the Trauma Society. And, you know, you keep pushing it with the Trauma Society. This trauma will come through the trauma unit first. And then we'll be calling, you know, it's not very seldom to go straight to the vasculars. It'll come to the trauma unit and then we'll call the vasculars and say, listen, the traumas with the Trauma Society people. And we're quite a big society and we've got lots of members. And you know, I think that's where I would push it.
Can you perhaps describe to us what sort of vascular injuries a trauma surgeon in a unit such as Edendale would consider taking on, and what type of injuries they would generally refer to Professor Pillay in Durban?
I'd like to refer all of them, but we have to. Right, so the principle is discuss it with the vascular people. You shouldn't be embarking on some operation and then when it all goes wrong, you sort of phone them. So you should be, you know, discussing up front and saying, this is what we need to do. I think brachials, I think, you know, we can do them within reason. That's fine. Subclavians, I think you want to try and stop the bleeding and you then, using a Foley balloon catheter, and then discuss it with vascular, and with the ideal being to try and stent that artery. I think rules you should be able to do. That's fairly straightforward. You know, it's a big artery. It holds stitches well. It's, you know, easy enough to get control. I think the popliteal is going to be the bête noire of all of us, because it's just a very difficult artery to operate on. You know, it's just not very forgiving. And if if you do these things all the time, like you guys do it, you're much better than if you do it once every 3 or 4 months. So ideally, I don't have a good answer for popliteals, because you don't have much time. So you really, if it's more than 6 hours, you can basically chop the leg off. So you do, you know, you, and to get it, and I mean, as Bala said, you know, in the old days, we could fly the patient to Durban. They take it by road transfer, and that's already 3-4 hours. So popliteals, I think, you know, you're going to be forced to deal with them if they've already got this prolonged period of ischemia. So that remains an artery where there's no good answer. The carotids, I think you don't want to be operating on those. You want to stop as a tamponade the bleeding, identify the injury, and then discuss it. I think there's lots of options now with the carotids. They can stent them. Feeling is increasing that you must try and revascularize carotid trauma in almost all patients, apart from those who are completely neurologically devastated. So I think you do want to try and, you know, speak to vascular, because you want to try and place some endovascular stent there or restore flow. And I think that's so to me, brachials, femorals are still in the realm of the trauma surgeon. Popliteals ideally should be done by a vascular. Subclavian should be stented and carotid should be seen by the vascular surgeons as well.
Thank you for that. Regarding the recommendations pertaining to endovascular treatment for grade 2 and in some grade 3 lesions, what is your experience and your advice for these injuries?
Okay, thank you for the question. I actually definitely agree in a stable patient for grade 2 injuries when there's a heavy fistula or, you know, there's a pseudoaneurysm. Again, it depends on the anatomical location of the injury. And or if it's a missed injury, the patient comes a few months down the line, which is quite common in our setting. And provided that is not an infected pseudoaneurysm, then and you're not dealing with a virgin anatomy, so the anatomy is quite distorted. It can be a surgical challenge, irrespective of how experienced you are. Then under those circumstances, I would prefer to. So in terms of grade 3 injuries, so those are injuries that we would also elect to treat in terms of stenting or coiling. In terms of the outcome, as I say, we don't know the long-term results. The frank transection, then under those circumstances, we would elect to actually stent the patient and treat them by endovascular means.
Prof. Pillay, Recommendation 89 of the guidelines states that non-operative management may be considered for grade 1 and 2 vascular injuries using observation and further re-imaging. This was a Class 2B recommendation. How relevant is this in South Africa, where follow-up has generally been quite difficult? Do you tend to have a more aggressive approach to these type of injuries?
What you are referring to back in the day, because we deal with an indigenous population and the follow-up was poor, but now with the evolution of technologies, just about everybody has a cell phone and with Wi-Fi and so forth. So we're able to follow the patient up. So I would agree on selective conservatism, provided that the patient can have good surveillance in terms of a duplex imaging and so forth, and they can be followed up regularly. Minimal vascular injury, so it comes down to a case of semantics. So some refer to it as proximal injuries. Some people say minimal vascular injuries. But I would rather say it's good to look at the lesion first on imaging and see what it actually does before you actually embark and make an argument for selective conservatism. If the vessel is occluded, we don't know the natural history of these lesions, so we'd prefer to manage them conservatively. So in terms of the recommendation, you know, it's basically moderate grade. But as I say, the numbers have been small. And if you look at the follow-up of these patients, it was for a short period of time. I think Pan et al. With these 20 patients opted to go for an operative approach on these patients. So in terms of our local policy, it depends on the anatomical location of the lesion. And secondly, whether it has a flow-limiting effect or not. And again, it comes down whether it's an isolated injury or in the context of polytrauma patients. Because often from our trauma unit, we've had polytrauma patients with evidence of an intimal injury of the subclavian artery. Again, if anticoagulation is not contraindicated, then we have to look at the risk-benefit ratio and we would go for that option. Thank you.
Would you, Professor Clark, consider managing these injuries conservatively?
So just to get back to being the general surgeon, so he's not bleeding, it's not a critical ischemia issue, so we've got time to discuss with the vascular surgeons. So we tend to be guided by them. I must say, I've seen a few of them, both from a Buller's unit that we've sent down there and from some of the ones in private where our vascular have treated them with, initially I was a bit skeptical. I was always taught there's no such thing as a minimal vascular injury, and that if you don't operate on this intimal flap, he's going to thrombose and all these, you know, things. And I've been, I must say, you know, with some of these modern antiplatelet agents, I've been quite impressed. I mean, I think I've seen carotid, which they treated non-operatively with, and that did well. There have been a few, even popliteals, you know, there was a blunt sort of, you know, popliteal flap, but there was perfusion. You know, then the vascular surgeon says, no, just put it on clopidogrel. And you think, well, that's great, buddy, because I'm sitting with the patient and you sitting a little bit down the road, the patient actually did well. So I've become cautiously optimistic about treating these minimal injuries, you know, with just antiplatelet agents. I think it does work. You have to discuss with your vascular surgeon, you have to observe the patient, and you have to image the patient properly. So yes, it can be done. And I think it's probably the way of the forward. I mean, I think a lot of these injuries and these difficult to get to places that are not huge, big grade threes and fours, you can treat non-operatively.
Thank you for that. We've talked already a little bit about endovascular repair. Professor Pillay, if we consider the types of penetrating trauma that are common in South Africa, specifically gunshot and stab wounds, is there any indication that one or both of these are particularly well suited or indeed badly suited to endovascular repair in your experience?
Look, because we don't have the good fortune of an hybrid theater, so we would intervene from an endovascular perspective on a stable patient. Secondly, both these mechanisms of injuries are suitable to endovascular intervention. With the expertise we have gained in the unit, we have stented carotid injuries, we have stented iliac injuries, and we have stented subclavian injuries. Professor Clark has mentioned the popliteal injuries, especially when they are delayed or the injury is missed. Patient comes 3 or 4 months down the line. Under those circumstances, we would elect to actually put in a stent as bridging therapy. And once edema and all that settles down, then we can go and do a definitive care.
Have you had any problems where a penetrating injury, such as a gunshot wound or a stab, that is potentially contaminated, has resulted in late stent infection?
We haven't had that challenge to my knowledge, because you see, the good thing about those type of injuries, like especially the neck, these injuries can be actually not single injuries. They could be other structures that are injured. The good thing about this technology is that you are accessing the lesion remotely from the site of injury. So it avoids all the challenges that actually come. A fair amount of our patients have got retroviral disease, and they're also subjected to trauma. So we haven't had any issues in terms of putting these stents. Look, I mean, in theory, because it's prosthetic material, stands to reason if you've got contamination, you actually can have some form of contamination.
Thank you for that additional information. This interesting discussion wraps up the Extra External Perspective episode on the new ESVS Vascular Trauma Guidelines. Thank you both for joining us today and sharing your time and expertise with us. It has been a pleasure.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you, Lawrence. Thank you. I enjoyed that very much. It was always interesting chatting to people with different perspectives, and I think I learned a lot.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
Thank you all out there for listening. A lot of new podcasts are coming up this year. Make sure to follow our socials to be in the loop of next releases. Have a great day. Goodbye.